everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish, and today I have my first guest host, well, actually my second, since Yvette was the first, but my first host that is a friend slash coworker who graciously agreed to take part in this, as I will be hitting up many a coworker and friend in the months to come. So welcome, Mandy.
Thanks, and thanks for having me first. I feel special.
You are special. All right. So I want to give a little shout out to one of our listeners that gave us a lovely review on Apple Podcasts, and that is Evil Apple, which I thought was an awesome name.
That is
name.
A fantastic name.
It is a fantastic name. So thank you, Evil Apple, for taking the time and giving us a lovely review. And to all of our listeners out there, whatever platform you listen to us on, please, if you could take the time and give us a review, we'd greatly appreciate it. If you give us 5 stars, we'd appreciate it more.
They deserve it, guys. They deserve it all over the world. We're loving it.
We are in a lot more countries. And I got to say, Amy S. took the time and put us out on some of her Facebook groups down there, True Crime Brooks, in Australia. She's the one that gave us the Tiffany Taylor, Jade Kendall case. And yeah, we've seen our listeners in Australia grow. So thank you, Australia.
That is awesome.
Yes. All right. So we're going to get started. Now, this episode, we're recording in September, but it's going to come out in October, the month of Halloween.
That is awesome, because this is a fantastic case for October.
It is. So I thought I'd kick it off with, I was thinking, oh, yeah, like what horror movies when I was younger scared the crap out of me? And one of them stands out. And I'll talk about it a little later on how I came to watch this. But this is what this episode is based upon. And as soon as I tell you the location, everybody's going to know. So we're going to the village of Amityville, located in Suffolk County on Long Island in New York State. It's considered an upscale community today, as it was back in the 1970s when this story takes place. Now, according to village history, the town's name came about during a contentious meeting in 1846, with one resident proclaiming that the meeting needed some amity. Now, another story has it that one resident, Samuel Ireland, a local mill owner, named the town after his boat, Amity, which means friendly relationships.
Which does not go along with this story.
No, there was not friendly relationships going on, no. So Amityville was made famous by what our episode is on today, and that is the murders committed on November 13th, 1974, at 112 Ocean Avenue. So at 6 a.m. on November 13th, an Amityville resident walking his dog noticed something strange coming from the DeFeo residence. He saw that the third floor lights in the house were on, and it was out of the ordinary, as they had never been on at that time of the morning when he had taken his dog out. So I'm talking about those famous cat-eye windows at the top of 112 Ocean Avenue.
Gotta love it that your neighbors are looking in your window up
top. But think about it. If you have a routine where you're always kind of walking and
you notice those little things.
Little things, and that stuck out to this neighbor. The DeFeo residence was a large 5-bedroom Dutch colonial with 3 floors, located on the south shoreline of Long Island, along the Amityville Canal. I also believe they call it the Amityville Creek, and that led out into the bay. So originally built in 1927, the DeFeos moved in 1965. Its occupants at the time were Ronald DeFeo Sr., he was also known as Big Ronnie, and his wife Louise, along with their 5 children. Ronald, though he went by the name of Butch, was 23, Dawn, 18, Allison, 13, Mark, 12, and John Matthew, 9. So 112 Ocean Avenue had been a gift from Luis's father, Michael Berganti Sr.
That's quite a gift.
That is a nice gift. Who was a partner in a successful car dealership, the Berganti Carl Buick, located in Brooklyn, New York. Now, there were also rumors that Michael Berganti had connections to organized crime. So at 6:30 a.m., Butch had arrived at his grandfather's car dealership, where he had been employed for several years, working odd jobs around the clerical and service departments. So he had arrived so early, the dealership wasn't even open, so he parked his car in front of the garage service doors. And he was discovered sleeping behind the wheel of his 1970 blue Buick Electra 225 sedan by the other service manager. So Big Ronnie was also employed at his father-in-law's dealership as the co-service manager. So Big Ronnie had yet to arrive for work that day, but no one really seemed worried, as they all knew that Mark DeFeo had sustained a serious football injury in September that required him to use crutches and a wheelchair to get around, and he was going through intense physical therapy at the time. So November 13th just happened to be one of Mark's physical therapy days. So Big Ronnie had told his co-workers in the preceding days that he most likely would not be in that day because of the doctor appointments. That morning, one of the DeFeo's neighbors arrived to pick up the children for school. I guess they had kind of an off and on carpool thing going on. That is nice.
Sounds like today's world.
Yes. So Catherine O'Reilly notices that both of DeFeo's cars are in the driveway, but no one answers the door. Now, this was pre-cell phone.
That would be totally weird, though. I think I'd keep banging there or something.
Well, she did for quite some time, and she's kind of like, what's going on here? You got two adults, and at least at this time, not knowing if Butch was home or not, five kids in the house, and there's no noise coming from
that's
inside.
Crazy.
So she had to leave to go take her children to school. She drops them off. She returns to the DeFeo residence again around 8:40 to try again because she's just like, okay, something's not right here. But again, no one answers the door. Catherine would call the DeFeo residence around 5 p.m. that evening. But again, no one answered. She thought, well, maybe they left suddenly and were out of town and they didn't get a chance to call me.
Right. So weird that both the cars are in the driveway.
This kind of did not set right with her. She's kind of like, something's not right here.
That's a long break between 8:40 a.m. and 5 p.m.
True. And none of the kids were in school. So around 10:30 a.m., a mailman had arrived at the DeFeo residence and noted that the family dog, named Shaggy, a sheepdog, didn't bark as he usually did when he came up to the front door. And the only time that doesn't happen is when the dog is tied up in the backyard. So when he noted when he was leaving the residence that the dog was not in the backyard. So again, something that just out of the ordinary that people notice, not knowing what going to transpire, but they're all kind of the neighbor walking the dog in the morning notices the lights. The neighbor coming over to pick up the children for school, nobody's answering the door. The mailman who's there that usually the dog's barking, nothing. So three different individuals are like, something's not right here.
Crazy. As a mailman, you'd think that you might say something to the neighbor if they've seen him at all. But yet again, people could be at work.
That is true. So I don't think they had any idea what was going to transpire. Now, around 6:30 that evening, Butch DeFeo runs into Henry's bar, which is about two blocks from the DeFeo residence. He is visibly upset. He's crying. He's hyperventilating. He finds his friend, Bobby Kelsey, and grabs him, stating, "You have to help me. Someone shot my mother and father." Now, Butch had been at Henry's bar in the afternoon hours. After he left work, he had gone to the bar. He'd hung out with friends. He had told them, "Hey, I don't know what's going on. I forgot my keys this morning, so I can't get into the house. And my parents aren't answering the phone, but their cars are in the driveway." So he's telling all these bar patrons kind of.
But I find it interesting how many people do not have their house key on their car keychain.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes, that is a good question. So he has told them this story and he says, "Well, I'm going to go home and see if I can break into the house and find out what's going on." So that's when he leaves, but then he comes back around 6:30, visibly upset. So Butch, along with Bobby and the other patrons of the bar, climb into Butch's car and return to the DeFeo residence. Now, Butch refuses to go into the house at this time. He's like, no. And he stays by his car. So the other men enter the residence and make their way to the master bedroom. And that's when they see two adults lying on their stomach. The male, Big Ronnie, had a bullet wound in his back. Now, if you Google the DeFeo family murders and hit images, it'll bring up a plethora of crime scene photos. And you can clearly see Big Ronnie lying on his stomach in his boxers with a bullet hole and blood coming out of it in his back.
This is a great Halloween story.
You can find anything on the Google. So the female, who was Louise, is lying under the covers but not moving. So the men left the bedroom, returned downstairs where Joe Yeswit dials 911 from the family phone. Now, John Altieri, another of the bar patrons, ran back upstairs to check the children's room. He entered the northeast bedroom where he saw Mark and John Matthew both lying on their stomachs with gunshot wounds to their backs. So he returns outside and he confirms that there are two additional victims. So at this point, we now have four.
Does nobody know that he has more siblings?
That's coming. So village police officer Kenneth Graguski was notified at the shootings at 112 Ocean Avenue. So when he arrived, he saw the guys, he got their stories. He went into the home and confirmed what the men had noticed. Two adults, two young males, all lying on their stomachs, all shot in the back in their respective beds. So he phones into headquarters and asked for the Suffolk County homicide detectives to come to the scene. Now, it was then that Butch told Officer Graguski that, "Well, I have two sisters." So Graguski goes back upstairs where he discovers Allison on the second floor in her bedroom on her bed and Dawn in her bedroom up on the third floor, both of them lying on their stomachs, both shot in the head.
So I find it crazy that Butch has not called 911 by himself, that he sat in his car and made his buddies go in and look for any more dead bodies, and the fact that they're all laying on their stomach dead with shots to the back. How is nobody in that house hearing shots from the other rooms?
And we're going to discuss that, because that's one of the things you're kind of like, but I agree with you. I was like, okay, I get not, if you've gone into the house, you discover your parents dead, you're getting the heck out of there. I get that. I get not stopping and using the phone in your house, but why not just run over to a neighbor's house?
Right, bang on their doors. Did you hear anything? What's going on? I need to call 911.
He runs into the bar at 6:30. You know everybody's awake. There's probably neighbors outside, but
I'm not going to run back to the bar. I am not running to a bar to say, hey, my parents are
shot. He didn't run to the bar. He drove to the bar.
But I'm not going to drive to the bar either.
No, I get that. I think that's one of the things when I first was researching this story, I was kind of like, why not go to the neighbor's house to use the phone to call for help? Like, that just stuck out to me. Like, why are you getting back in a car driving? I would imagine erratically if you're that upset.
Plus, you've already drank during the day.
Well, yes. So probably should not be driving. By 6:45 p.m., homicide detectives from Suffolk County Police Department arrive on scene. Though this is pretty quick. He went to the bar at 6:30, 6:45. We have homicide detectives on scene. And there are six detectives in total surveying the crime scene. And they set up a command post initially in the kitchen of the house, posting Officer Griguski at the front door to allow only those necessary into the residence. They don't want people trampling through the crime scene, family members, friends, curiosity seekers. So by 7 p.m., the detectives have started to span out and start interviewing the DeFeo neighbors. Again, what have you seen? What haven't you seen? What sticks out to you that isn't quite right going on here? So needless to say, the area around 110 Ocean Avenue was becoming quite chaotic, with bystanders on the sidewalk, cars constantly driving by, as news of the DeFeo family murders has spread through this small village.
I can only imagine seeing the news.
Well, you know, it's not the news at that point. It's just word of
mouth.
Yeah,
you're right. Not like today.
Yeah. People picking up their landlines, not posting on Facebook or anything.
Yeah, you don't even have the cordless phones at that point. You're stretching that cord out the door. What's going on?
That's right. Detective Robert Burkhart began to question Butch DeFeo in the kitchen of the home, and that's when he noticed that the bottom portion of a window was open in the kitchen. So Butch told him that he had to break into that window to get into the house, as he didn't have his keys with him and nobody was answering the door when he knocked. However, it was during their discussion that the storm window on that window came crashing down and shattered, indicating that you didn't really break the window to get in. So that just kind of stuck out to that police officer, like, what's going on here? Why is he saying he broke in when clearly it doesn't look like he did? So family members of the DeFeo start to arrive, and most importantly is Luis's father, Michael Burgatti Sr., and he's interviewed in the kitchen area and tells detectives his son-in-law, Big Ronnie, had told him about receiving some suspicious phone calls in the days and weeks leading up to the murder. So around 7:30 p.m., the police had anyone not related to law enforcement to leave the DeFeo residence, and they moved the command center to a nearby neighbor's home. So by 7:45, Butch DeFeo is taken to police headquarters for a formal interview. And there were also concerns that the murders may have been mob-connected, and they wanted to protect the only surviving family member at this point. So Butch's various interviews as the night went on, he claimed that his family's murders were due to a mob hit. And he even named the enforcer, Louis Fellini, as the alleged hitman. So while the police are dealing with Butch at the station, Dr. Howard Edelman of the Suffolk County Medical Examiner's Office arrives on scene, and he begins his examinations of the bodies, and other crime scene detectives begin to arrive by 8 p.m. and begin photographing and fingerprinting the scene. There would be over 101 color crime scene photos taken inside and outside the DeFeo residence that night. So after naming Fellini as a possible suspect in his family's murders, Butch told the detectives what he did prior to discovering his parents' bodies. Now, he claimed he was up late watching TV and he just couldn't sleep, so he decided to leave for work early that morning. And I think he says he left around 4 a.m., could possibly be 4:30 a.m., to make the drive into Brooklyn. He thought that his family at that point when he left were still alive. They were just all sleeping up in their beds. He told them that he couldn't get a hold of his family all day, and when he arrived home and saw his parents' car in the driveway, he was kind of like, okay, what's going on here? But he knocked on the door to try to get in because, again, he forgot his keys, but no one would answer. So after he left work, It sounds like he went to Henry's bar. He hung out with some friends for a while. Then he decided to go home. Nobody was answering the door. And that's when he decided to break into the window. And then he went up to his parents' bedroom and then found them dead. He says he then got in his car, drove back to Henry's bar, and they know the story from there. So Butch was placed in protective custody at the time, but police did not name him from a suspect. I watched, and I think it's in the resource section of the notes, I put a YouTube video of a newscast that took place on the 14th, so the day after the murders, and a police detective is telling reporters that no, he's not a suspect. He's just in protective custody at this point. So, however, some things were not adding up for detectives. Detectives found an empty box for a 35 caliber Marlin gun in Butch's room, but there was no 35 caliber gun found in the home at the time. So when they questioned Butch about the gun and the box in his room, Butch at the time was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, played off like I have no idea why that would be there. Yeah.
Might have forgot to take that box out of there.
That's correct. Now, the autopsies were being conducted starting on the 14th, and a timeline of the murders began to develop, indicating that the victims had been killed sometime in the early morning hours of November 13th, 1974. They would actually place the time of the killings between 3 and 3:30. I think if we want to take an average, 3:15 a.m. Now, per Butch's statements, he would have been home at the time because he didn't leave for work till about 4:30 a.m. The autopsies would also show that each member of the family had been shot with 35 caliber bullets. Each of the victims were found face down with their hands raised above their heads. Now, early speculation was the family had been drugged in some way, possibly from something they ate. And this could explain how no one seemed to move from their beds when the shooting started. However, there were no drugs or sedatives found in the victim's systems. So that theory doesn't fly, which makes you wonder again, like, how does that happen? I watched another YouTube video because I don't own guns. So I want to be like, okay, what's the sound? Every article I read said this was a high powered rifle and right. It makes a lot of noise. So I watched this video on YouTube that, yeah, it really does, which got me thinking, whoever the killer is, goes into the parents' bedroom and fires their shots there. You got to think it's going to wake up the other people, at least on the same floor, which are the two boys and the girl. But no one seemed to move from their bed.
Yeah. And in deer season, you can hear people shooting their guns all the time.
That is true. This is Pennsylvania.
You would think that you'd be hearing gunshots. And I still find it weird that everyone's laying face down with their hands above their head.
It is weird. Yes, it is very weird. I watched this interview with the pathologist who said that there are questions that they don't seemingly have answers for. And that's one of them. Why they're all on their stomachs, why they all have their hands above their heads, yet they're not sedated. If they were sedated, yeah, you could probably pose them. Right. And maybe someone did pose them after they were dead.
And if the siblings are sharing rooms,
yeah,
how are you not hearing that your sibling's being shot right next to you?
And let's remember, Mark DeFeo had a serious spinal injury. He couldn't lay on his stomach. Somebody might have posed him. So equally as puzzling was that none of the neighbors heard 8 shots from a high-powered rifle. All they heard that morning was the DeFeo family sheepdog Shaggy barking in the early morning hours, but that really wasn't an unusual occurrence. So again, these neighbors are literally right next door, right across the street. There are not yards of land between them.
You're definitely going to hear this. If you live anywhere in Pennsylvania where there's woods behind your house, you are hearing everyone shooting their guns during deer season.
It is. Yes. You do get used to it, though, because you hear it so often. But in this case,
I'm thinking it's not happening here in this
I'm not thinking in the village of Amityville that is a regular occurrence. I will say Shaggy does make it. Shaggy was not shot. So I just want to put that out there because I needed to know what happened to the dog.
That's crazy.
Now, looking at the victim's stomach contents show that there was a period of time between when the victims last ate and when they died. So again, somewhere in those early morning hours or when they died. So if they ate dinner, let's say between 6 and 8 p.m., that's a good 6-7 hours before they're murdered. Each of the victims bore powder marks on their bodies, indicating the gun had been in close proximity when it was fired. So this isn't somebody standing feet away. This is somebody standing maybe a foot away.
Still blown away that no one's hearing this.
Blown away? Really? Is that? That's a bad pun.
That was.
So Big Ronnie and Luis were each shot twice in the back and side. Dawn and Allison were each shot once in the head that penetrated their brains. And Mark and John Matthew were each shot once in their backs. Now, when confronted by the detectives with these new findings, Butch began to change his story, which for true crime listeners is never a good thing to change your story. So this time he claimed that Fellini had broken into his house and had threatened him by placing a gun to his head. He went on to say that Fellini and an accomplice had taken room to room and had him watch while his family was murdered. However, Fellini had a really strong alibi in that he was not even in the state of New York at the time of the murders. So after some additional questioning, Butch finally broke down and confessed to murdering his entire family, claiming that once he started, he couldn't stop. And quote, "It went so fast," unquote. Butch would tell investigators where they could find the murder weapon, a 35 caliber Marlin rifle. So he did actually know what that box belonged to. He said he threw it off the back of the property into the Amityville Canal. He would also lead investigators to a drainage pipe where he had hid his bloody clothes and towel on the way to work that morning. So who is Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr.? He was born in Brooklyn, New York on September 26, 1951. Now, although raised in an upper middle class lifestyle, wanting for nothing, Butch had a troubled childhood. Being the oldest of five DeFeo children, Butch took on not only the expectations of his overbearing father, but also his wrath at times. Big Ronnie was known to have an explosive temper and would often take his anger out on Butch. And this abuse started when Butch was 18 months old. I read one story where a family friend, they had been down in the basement of the home and Butch did something and his father just threw him into a wall, like hitting his shoulder and his head on this wall. He's 18 months old.
That is crazy. And to think that the next youngest is 18, so 5 years of abuse, and his wife wanted to have another kid with him.
She had more than one.
It's four more.
He ended up having five kids total. Now, his wife and the other siblings, they experienced abuse as well. So it just wasn't all Butch when the other ones came along, and even his wife. I also have in the resource section a YouTube video from biography.com. It's called bio.com, but it was an interview that a psychiatrist had done with Butch DeFeo, and they interview other people, family, friends, and jurors in this interview. It's really quite fascinating. And one, I think it was the family friend, said that there are times that he would go over to the house and Butch's mom, in the middle of the day, would have sunglasses on in the home because she had a black eye. So when Butch was younger, he was overweight and had a brooding disposition. That often led him to being picked on and bullied by his classmates. Now, as Butch grew older, he would emulate his father's physical outbursts, at times having physical altercations with his father and friends. Now, this led to his parents wanting Butch to see a psychiatrist, but Butch really wasn't interested in therapy as he didn't think he needed it.
He's probably thinking, how about my dad goes and gets some help instead?
Like, I can get all the help in the world, but unless you take care of the source of this anger, that's not really going to change anything. So in place of counseling, Butch's parents decided instead to lavish him with gifts, such as a $14,000 speedboat, because they had a boathouse on the property. And they were hoping that these gifts would act as an incentive for Butch to kind of straighten out, to go to school, to do what he's supposed to do.
Quite an incentive. I couldn't even imagine. In the 80s, that's a
70s.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's quite an expensive boat then. Yeah, you're right. 70s.
$14,000. Yeah.
I couldn't even imagine what that is right now. A lot.
That'd be a lot. So at the age of 17, Butch would begin using LSD, followed by heroin, and he would end up being expelled from school due to his violent outbursts. Now, up to the murders of his family, Butch had been drinking about a fifth of scotch a day and shooting heroin daily.
Quite a life.
Ooh. That's quite a messed up life.
That
because
is a quite a messed up life.
You got to think of the damage you're really doing to yourself. So Butch's parents didn't want to seem to engage in the tough love approach still, and instead secured a job at his grandfather's Buick dealership for Butch when he was 18 years old. Big Ronnie would pay a stipend to Butch on a weekly basis, regardless if he showed up for work on time or at all, and it didn't appear that his job performance affected his salary in any way. So it's kind of like,
man.
Yeah, I know.
just show up. I wish we had that job.
That would be great, but that's not the way life works.
No, it isn't. isn't.
So access to money and his parents still providing incentives for him allowed him not only to abuse more drugs, but also to get into buying guns as well. So Butch's behavior appeared to become more volatile as he grew older. There were incidents where he would threaten his father with a 12-gauge shotgun at one point, pointing it directly into his father's face and pulling the trigger. However, the gun malfunctioned. There was a bullet in the gun. So this was I think we can say this, very, very volatile household. Very dysfunctional household, too.
Right, and I think Butch has about had enough with his dad beating the crap out of him. And
you betcha. So in September of 1974, Butch, so this is about 2 months before the murders, Butch, along with a friend, stole an outboard motor from the Babylon Town dock using his speedboat in the theft. So that was the getaway vehicle. And he was convicted and received a year of probation for petite larceny on December 14th. Keep in mind that he was already under arrest at this point. I mean, he's convicted on December 14th. The murders happened in November.
Oh, yeah.
So Butch was not quite happy with the stipend and the gifts that he was getting from his family. So he decided, I'm going to steal $19,000 from my grandfather's dealership. And he decided this on November 1st, 1974. So he'd already been arrested for the outboard motor theft, waiting to be convicted for that. And he decides to steal this money from his grandfather, who may or may not have ties to organized crime.
That's real smart. Kid's got, what, a $14,000 boat, gets a weekly stipend. And
for doing nothing.
Right.
Yeah. But again, he's a drug addict and he's an angry young man.
True.
So he set up a mock robbery because he was supposed to deposit the money in the bank. I'm not sure who would trust him to deposit this money because that was my other question. Why would you do this? He's not even a reliable employee. But irregardless, he was given this money to deposit and he set up this mock robbery with another coworker, Arthur Beelan, agreeing to help him if they split the money in half. Butch might have gotten away with it had he been able to remain calm when questioned by police. Instead, he decided to explode on the officer questioning him and would not cooperate with the investigation. So when questioned by his father, asked, why did you do this? Why would you do this? Why would you do this to your grandfather? Butch just threatened to kill him.
I guess drugs and alcohol.
That's correct. Now keep in mind, this was November 1st. The murders happened 12 days later. So on October 14th, 1975, Butch DeFeo stands trial on 6 counts of second-degree murder. Justice Thomas Stark presided over the trial. Now, DeFeo's attorney, William Weber, mounted an insanity defense, claiming that Butch had heard voices telling him to kill his family. And a defense psychiatrist, Dr. Daniel Schwartz, diagnosed Butch as being neurotic, who suffered from a dissociative disorder and clearly auditory hallucinations. So assistant district attorney Gerard Sullivan didn't buy the insanity plea, and he had the state psychiatrist, Dr. Harold Zolin, testify that Butch did not have a dissociative disorder, as the defense expert testified to, but he had an antisocial personality disorder, and that's characterized by having a lack of empathy, emotional problems, self-centeredness that is abnormal, a tendency to rely on deception, also lying and cheating. And antisocials also have a hard time following rules. Meaning, Butch DeFeo knew what he was doing was wrong, but he just didn't care. Now, keep in mind, at the crime scene, Butch had picked up all the shell casings. He threw away or hid the evidence from the crime scene. That takes some forethought. That's not a psychotic break.
You're definitely knowing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Or at least trying to cover up what you did.
Right.
So, November 21st, 1975, the jury agreed with the prosecution's theory and found Butch guilty on all 6 counts of second-degree murder. Butch DeFeo was sentenced to 6 concurrent sentences of 25 years to life. Now, he did become eligible for parole since then 2 times, the last one being in 2015. Both have been denied. I would be shocked if they let him out.
I would really hope not.
So after his conviction, Butch began to change his story again about who actually conducted the killings. So in one story, I read 2 different stories that he had. And in that bio.com interview, he does tell one of the stories. So his first story was that Don ended up killing their father, and their mother, who was so distraught, decided to kill Don and his siblings. And then he only killed his mom. Now, in a 2005 interview, again, with the psychiatrist from bio.com, Butch claimed that his sister, Don, it was her idea to kill their entire family. He says that they went to their parents' bedroom and Dawn was really upset that evening because Big Ronnie had refused to let her go to Florida with her boyfriend. So she was really angry. And again, all of these kids have been abused. they're living under the roof of a tyrant.
Right.
And so they go to their parents' bedroom, and Butch said he fired the gun at his father, who he claimed was coming after him, like had gotten up, had heard him at the doorway, had gotten up, was approaching him, and he fired. But Butch claims, I only went in there to scare him.
Nothing like taking a shotgun in to scare your dad.
Well, keep in mind, Big Ronnie was found lying on his stomach with a gunshot wound to the middle of his back. I'm not sure how he's coming at you if he's lying on his stomach. Yeah. So he then fired the shots that killed his mother, who was reaching for her own gun, he claimed. This every member of this family, I just said.
They've got a...
had weapons everywhere.
Of guns in this house.
So he claims he left the house after he killed his mother and father and went for a drive to cool down, leaving Don and his siblings alive. Now, when he returned home, he found Allison, Mark, and John Matthew had all been murdered. And he went to confront Dawn in her bedroom. Again, her bedroom being on the third floor of the house. And that's when Dawn tried to shoot him. He claims they started fighting, and in the struggle, Butch got the gun and shot Dawn in her head. Now, Butch claimed that Dawn hated their father, and she actually despised Allison, that she was very jealous of her younger sister, Allison. So it was during this interview, Butch claimed that on November 3rd, 1974, 10 days before the murder, around 11 p.m., Big Ronnie and him had gotten into a fight where Big Ronnie actually broke a pool stick over his head while his mother cheered Big Ronnie on. Again, this is his version. Yeah, not that it was true.
That's quite a version. I mean, his story. He's really thinking up some good stories here.
So it was in that moment, he claims, he decided he was going to kill his father.
I still find it amazing that after he's saying that he shot his mother and father, that he left the four siblings in the house and not worrying about them. Hey, I'm going to go on a drive, but let me leave my siblings in the house with two dead parents.
And a loaded shotgun, apparently, you know. It just doesn't make sense. So in December of 1975, okay, so Butch has been tried. He's been convicted. He's doing his time in prison. The house goes back up on the market, and it is sold to new owners, George and Kathy Lutz, and Kathy's three children from her first marriage. So they actually paid, I think $400 for some of the furniture from the DeFeo family, because it was still in the home and they liked it. So I guess they wanted to keep it.
No, thank you.
Not sure I would, but no. Okay. So they move in, but they would not be there very long. They were only in the home about 28 days before fleeing, claiming they had experienced paranormal events that started right after they moved into the home. So they even said that prior to moving in, the Lutzes had hired a priest to come and bless the house because they knew the story. They knew what had happened in there. They weren't buying this house blind, but they got a really good deal. I think they said they only paid $80,000, but still, in 1975, that's a lot of money. I think George Lutz had a surveying company, so he was a business owner, but they claimed, you know, again, when they move in, they're seeing like all of this paranormal activity, like rooms would be, you'd walk into a room and it would be like freezing cold, like you're in the middle of Alaska, like there's no reason for it to be that cold, that the toilets would bubble up with like black goo.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You'd see things outside the window, like demonic eyes looking in from the window. I think the younger daughter had like an invisible friend, which nobody could see, but she could see. So there were just all these things
crazy
that unnerved them, and they laughed.
I give them credit for even buying the house in the first place. I think I'd look and look and look before I would
Well, there's some controversy about it. Some people do not believe what the Lutzes claimed. Now, when they left the home, they actually sold their story to a publisher who hired Jay Anson. And he, of course, wrote The Amityville Horror. And that was published in September of 1977. Again, based upon the claims of the Lutzes. Now, in 1979, the Amityville Horror movie was released, starring James Brolin, Margot Kidder, and Ron Steiger. Now, I think this came out on TV, probably 80, 81, if I'm remembering correctly. And my mom and I wanted to see it. So I remember us sitting in our living room, every light is on, and we're watching this movie on a black and white 13-inch television, and it still scared the hell out of me. I mean, at the time, I was like, whoa. I mean, today, flies in the window still set me on edge. When I see one fly, I'm like, oh, there better not be any more, because I know what this means. And I just remember it was one of the first horror movies I really remember watching that, yeah.
You're
every light's
for
on.
The nightmares,
and I might have kept the lights on in my bedroom for a while at night.
A little bit.
So that movie actually grossed $80 million domestically. Now, the house depicted in the movie was not actually the real house at 1112 Ocean Avenue. It was actually in Toms River, New Jersey. Jersey. And since then, since the first movie of the Amityville Horror, there have been approximately 22 movies that have spawned off from the original work. Now, there was controversy around the story because DeFeo's attorney, William Weber, had come out, had actually sued the Lutzes because he claimed they had gotten together, or the Lutzes had approached him about making up these stories, to buying the house, moving in for a little bit, and then claiming all this paranormal activity to sell the story and make some money, and that they were kind of going into this together. And he ended up suing them for like breach of contract or something like that, and are trying to cut him out of the deal. And I think they did settle out of court. He didn't get what he was asking for. But again, that's kind of the controversy around it.
So that reason they only stayed 28 days just to create this movie.
Maybe. I also read another article where they both took lie detectors tests and passed, both of the Lutzes and the Lutzes' children as adults now. They have come out and said, yeah, we experience these paranormal activities. I'm not saying they're not telling the truth, because there were 6 murders in this house. And so 1112 Ocean Drive has had various owners since then, and none of them have reported any paranormal activity outside of George and Kathy Lutz. The last one I read, I think it was bought in 2015 by a retired school teacher and his wife, and it's totally been remodeled. It is gorgeous. I would move into that house now. It is gorgeous what they have done. I mean, it doesn't look anything like it did back in 1974. 1974, it had, okay, this was the 70s, and I do remember this, velvet wallpaper.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Have you never experienced velvet wallpaper?
I have not.
There was velvet wallpaper in my grandmother's home. You'd run your hand on it. It's just weird. But that's all gone. They have beautiful marble flooring. It's all light and airy, different paint. It's not the dark red colors.
Thank goodness.
The avocado greens, you know, that were so famous. Thank God. Yeah, you couldn't sell that now, but it is gorgeous. And they changed the windows. So those famous cat eye windows on the third floor are gone. They're now little square windows. So that does change the appearance. So that is the case of the DeFeo family murders, murdered by one of their own, Butch DeFeo, which spawned off the Amityville Horror. So I thought that was a good episode to start off the month of October.
That is a great story. That'll lead you right into Halloween.
I have to try to find some more that have a Halloween theme to it. I don't know if I will, but
there's no doubt about that. He is one crazy dude, though. Let's hope we never see him get released from jail.
I doubt he will. I will say this. Watch the bio.com interview. You can tell. You can tell the drugs have taken their toll. You can tell that he's just not right.
No, you wish that you could find out why he placed them all in their stomach and put their hands above their head.
Well, they don't know. He's never said about rearranging the bodies. He's never admitted to that. Well, he's also never admitted to really killing them except initially. But yeah, there are questions with this case. How did no one wake up? That gun is loud. How did no one do that? No, there is no sign of struggle. There's no sign that somebody tried to run out of the home or tried to barricade themselves in their room. There's nothing like that. So there are questions around this. That's why some people have speculated, was there possibly more than one shooter? But again, nothing has come. I've read some sites that said, yeah, this is some evidence that was overlooked and it maybe did that. I mean, it would make sense. But to this day, he confessed all the murders. He showed him where the murder weapon was. He showed him, and they all had the same injuries from the same bullet, from the same gun. So it doesn't really show two different intruders.
It'd be like you'd have to have 6 people in there with the same gun and shooting right at the same time.
You'd have different ballistics, even if it was the same kind of gun.
True.
So there are questions around this case. But either way, 6 family members lost their lives. It was a very dysfunctional home. You had a father that was very verbally, physically, emotionally, mentally abusive, who was a tyrant over his family, and something was bound to break.
Not any kid is going to get a little crazy from being abused for years.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode. If you'd like to reach out to us with any questions you have or any case suggestions you may have, drop us a line. You can go to our website at criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or there is a contact page there. Also, all of our show notes and resources are on there. And I would just say, you can also reach out to us through our Instagram page at criminaldispod, D-I-S-P-O-D, or our Facebook page, Criminal Discourse Podcast. We also have a YouTube channel by the same name and actually have some subscribers, which always amazes me. So,
look at that.
I know.
Definitely watch this movie at, after you've
listened
to this. Yeah, you should definitely watch this on Halloween night.
Maddie's mom and I are going to get together and watch it because she's never seen it. I'm like, okay, I think I'm old enough. I can watch it again.
I may never see Trish come to work.
You're
going to
see lights on everywhere I go. All right. Well, I want to take a moment and thank Mandy for taking her time out and joining me on this case. I greatly appreciate it.
Much fun.
Well, thank you. And if you'd like to be a guest host, I'd love to have you on. Just drop me a line through our contact page on our website. And if we can make it work, we'll make it work. All right. Well, thank you so much again for listening. We greatly appreciate it. And also those people that have told other people about our podcast, thank you, thank you, thank you. We are so grateful because we've definitely seen our listenership rise. And this is, you know, this is, as we've said previously, a labor of love. There's
no doubt in that.
Yeah. Well, as I always in the show, let's remember, if you see something, say something, you might have that missing piece of the puzzle that solves a crime. Like all those individuals who gave their little bit of information about the lights being on, about no one being home, about not hearing the dog. That little bit of information can help develop a picture and solve the crime. So we're still in this pandemic. We're anxiously awaiting a vaccine. So we need to still be careful. We need to watch out for one another. But we also remember to be kind to one another. And until next time, bye.
Bye.